This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, folks, welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. Got a very interesting guest lined up for you today, Karen Kriatkowski. She's got an impressive resume that she'll be telling us about, but she is a 9/11 Pentagon survivor. She's going to be telling her interesting story of what she saw and heard that day. Before I bring her on, just let me mention, again, the website for the People Speak Radio is thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you want to call in during the broadcast, if you have a question or comment for our guest, the number to do that, if you're calling internationally, is toll-free. The number is 877-489-6350. If you're calling from the U.S. or Canada, again, the toll-free number to do that is 888-228-4494. So always look forward to getting calls, getting questions, comments. Feel free to do so. And again, no cost to yourself. Okay, with no further ado, let me introduce our guest again. Her name is Karen Kriatkowski, and she was there on 9/11 at the Pentagon. So she's going to give us her first-person experience, testimony of what you know, what she saw transpiring that day. It's always good to get someone's testimony who's actually there, as opposed to reading it in a book or even watching the newsreels. You know, someone who actually was right there in the heat of the moment. So that's what we'll be looking at today. So, yeah, welcome to the show, Karen.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I'd like you to tell us first. I was looking over your resume. It's pretty impressive. You've got quite a few years of experience there working in, well, not only the Pentagon, but I guess prior to that you were in, what was it, the Air Force?
Yeah, I spent 20 years in the Air Force, and my final two tours were at the Pentagon. And I retired in early spring 2003. So,
wow.
And I was, in the Pentagon there on 9/11. And, the reason you probably know about me is not so much that I was there, because, of course, the Pentagon, I think, had about 22,000 folks there, 22,000 potential witnesses of what happened on 9/11. But shortly after that, I was transferred into the Near East South Asia Policy Directorate at the Office of Secretary of Defense. And so what I saw there, and it relates to 9/11 a little bit, was the propaganda campaign to basically justify to the American people anyway the invasion of Iraq. And a lot of it was made up. As we know today, we know it's made up today. I mean, we pretty much have
they wouldn't do that.
The truth. But we have a good many facts now about what was really going on. I actually witnessed that as well, working where I did, and some of the misuse and manipulation of intelligence that was done in order to kind of tell a story about why we need to.
Well, that's actually very interesting. I want to talk about that as well.
Big connections was 9/11, which, of course, Iraq had nothing to do with, but
sure.
That didn't stop the president and the vice president from claiming that it did.
Initially, oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you actually meet Rumsfeld personally? Or?
I never met Rumsfeld personally. I attended a couple of all-hands meetings where Rumsfeld spoke, but no, never met him personally, and never had to even brief him. I did have to brief Wolfowitz one time, but not Rumsfeld, no. Which is kind
of
a good thing.
Wow, but you did meet Wolfowitz, huh?
Yeah, he's kind of a
himself.
Actually, it's strange. Wolfowitz, if you follow neoconservative politics, Wolfowitz is seen as one of the key neoconservative ideologues, and certainly was a big player in pushing a lot of things that we now realize were not very smart, and certainly not in America's interest. But he is really comes across in person as a very nice, very nice and mild mannered person almost, which is kind of, kind of funny considering
maybe he went to acting school.
The real damage that he is partly responsible for in this country, but he's a real nice guy.
Oh yeah, well I mean he's a member of the you know, Project Blue American Century. I'm sure you heard of that.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And they were planning the Iraq War
and,
before Bush was even in office.
That's right. And, you know, Wolfowitz is part of a crowd of neoconservatives who really came to public power under Reagan, even though Reagan not necessarily, they weren't really truly Reagan's people, per se. In fact, a number of them, Richard Pearl is a key example, actually quit the Reagan administration when Reagan began to talk to Gorbachev and started reducing, some nuclear weapons, things
right,
like that.
Right, they didn't want that.
Once Reagan started to do the right thing, some of the neocons were very, upset with that and quit. Pearl was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But Wolfowitz and Pearl and a number of these guys, Frank Gaffney, a lot of these folks, Doug Feist, my old boss in policy, these folks came into government early on in the 80s under Reagan. And the enemy at that time, of course, was the Soviet communists. And we didn't end up having a hot war with the Soviets. The Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight for the most part. And, that's kind of a happy ending. I mean, because think about it, what it might have been, all those nuclear weapons pointed at each other. I mean, it could have been a very bad thing. But it was not, it didn't explode in a hot war. The Cold War ended in a whimper. And these guys, their whole orientation, their whole philosophy and ideology requires an evil enemy. And they got a new one and didn't take them very long.
I remember...
idea.
Yeah, they needed a replacement for the old Soviet threat.
Well, they need a replacement. And the idea of Islamo-fascism, which does not even exist, there is no such thing as Islamic fascism. It's a made-up concept.
Yeah,
it's kind of
ridiculous, too, if you think about it.
It really is. I mean, the religion of Islam, yeah, kind of would be involved in government, but fascism is the industry being managed and run and networked in 100% with the government. We're closer to fascism than any Islamic country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Iraq,
but that's
of course,
the way to do it, isn't it? You point fingers at others and blame them for what you're doing, so you look
well,
at
Well, you could do a whole show on that and probably have.
Yeah,
we have huge concern here with the directions that this country is going, and it certainly meets the criteria of National Socialism, but we can't use that word. But, Saddam Hussein was the farthest thing from an Islamic ruler, as you could imagine, being that he was secular and he had put in place communism, godless atheistic communism, I might add, in Iraq. And the people that hated him the worst were the religious folks, the folks that really wanted God to have a place in government.
But now, of course, they're emerging as the dominant force there.
Was one of his declared enemies.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
With him out of power, now the religious fanatics are emerging as the dominant force there.
Well, sure. And I think a lot of one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons that under the Reagan administration and even early Bush administration, Bush 1, Herbert Walker, we actually were still friends with Saddam Hussein. We helped put him in power years ago. He was our guy. Why was he our guy? Because he was a secular, leader in a country where there's a huge tendency to have, religious influence in government that we don't like.
Well, his problem is he ran out of usefulness.
Our guy.
He wore out his usefulness. That was his problem.
Well, he certainly did. Well, he didn't wear out his usefulness. His usefulness changed. Now he was useful as an enemy that we could justify invading a country.
Usefulness as far as keeping the power.
Well, sure.
I think it was 1991, Colin Powell was quoted in Soldier Fortune magazine. He actually said, "We're running out of enemies. We need new enemies." He actually said that.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't kidding.
Did he really? Yep. Well, you can't justify this massive military-industrial economy that we have. You can't justify that. You can't justify increased spending without enemies. And certainly one of the biggest fears of a lot of folks in the military, and I was in the military when the Cold War ended, was drawdown, base closure, the end of weapon systems, a whole number of things. And if your livelihood is around those business areas, you're going to, things are going to change. You're going to have to find a new line of work. And so there was anxiety. And it's one thing for a regular guy in the military, but if you're a company and your whole company makes weapons and needs purchasers for those weapons, what are you going to do? You need to have some justification, something that will drive leaders in government and congresses to to continue to provide your livelihood, which is to purchase your weapons and to demand new weapons. Of course, we've seen no slowdown at all since the Cold War. Nothing but growth, growth, growth. And, you know, the Warsaw Pact, I imagine people remember the Warsaw Pact. You know, it was NATO was the counterpart to the Warsaw Pact. Well, when the Warsaw Pact collapsed shortly after the Soviet Union did, it just disappeared. Of course, the weapons were sold in a variety of ways, but the organization evaporated. You would have think that NATO would have done that, would have followed suit. Certainly would have no reason for existing. But, of course, NATO instead grew, expanded, and sought new membership. So,
right.
And sought to redesign its mission to keep business. I mean, this is how it unfortunately seems to work. And you need enemies. You need enemies and you need fear.
Do you see that going on now with the Georgia-Russia crisis there? I see.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, yeah.
Absolutely, and of course, you know, there are people that see America having played a role in kind of encouraging the Georgian leader, who of course is one of our guys. I think the Rose Revolution, you know, we put millions and millions of dollars, National Endowment for Democracy helped him out hugely to try to get this guy Saakashvili in office, and we did that, succeeded in that. He's our guy, and a lot of people say, you know, we kind of you know, encouraged him, saying, oh, we'll back you up. Go ahead and do this. Because, you know, it's just...
And what a misnomer that is,
justice.
Endowment for Democracy. Right.
Oh, I know. It's really strange. For many years, I thought that was a very innocent organization, you know, and it sounds like the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, it sounds very non-threatening. and certainly positive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. So were you aware of this stuff back in your days of in the Air Force? You know, or did this come about more recently?
But not a huge amount, but I'll tell you, when in 1998, I was in the Air Staff, so I was in the Pentagon. I was not working for OSD, but for the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And in that capacity, my office mate, who was an F-15 pilot, he was in a position to... to help develop targets for the 1998 attacks, the Monica missiles. You remember the Monica missiles in 1998? It was around August or September 1998. And Bill Clinton had just been exposed to the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal had come up, and a lot of things were happening. And, of course, the neocons had constantly, really since 91, 92, 93, had been pushing to have the United States attack Saddam Hussein. We were certainly enforcing militarily the no-fly zones after the 91 Gulf War. So, you know, we're in a state of war that Americans don't really realize. And the neocons agitating in Washington out of power, certainly they were largely out of political power, but pushing for to make this Cold War with Iraq a hotter and hotter war. So Bill Clinton kind of bends over a little bit at this time, and there was some incident or whatever. And he develops targets. One set of targets was supposedly a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan, and the other set of targets was supposedly a chemical weapons lab in Sudan outside of Khartoum. Well, my office mate was one of the targeting guys, and he was describing to me after the fact, he was very upset coming back from the final meeting, and he said, look, we told them, we being the Air Force operators, told the staff that this factory was a pharmaceutical factory. It was not a chemical weapons factory.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with bin Laden, and it wasn't a good target. It was wrong. And you know why he was overruled and why we chose that target? Which, of course, we ended up paying the Saudi pharmaceutical company owner millions and millions of dollars for destroying his factory unlawfully. Well, in any case, that's after the fact. They were warned that this was not a good target, but what they said was, we can't just do one. We need a set of targets to make it look like we're fighting a comprehensive,
legitimate enemy,
against this enemy. And so, you know, this happened in 1998. I was kind of surprised because my sense of being in the military for the previous, 16 years, 17 years was, you know, we do things for the right reasons and we do them in the right way, meaning that we make the very best decisions based on the best information we have. And what that showed me, and this is long before I realized, I never knew what a neoconservative was, but this showed me that the military political decision-making system could care less about the best information, that it's really a political system.
Yeah.
A political system with weapons, massive, deadly weapons at its disposal. And that's what it kind of, I learned that. And I didn't think about it much, but it was just a little bit of opening of my eyes early on.
They're just itching to use them, but they need the right pretext.
Excuse me?
They're itching to use them. They just need the right pretext
to go in with it. Looking for a pretext, and it doesn't have to be even logical. It just has to be something we can sell. And it's really, increasingly, when you look at things work in Washington and in the Pentagon, that almost everything is really about advertising and sales campaigns more than anything else. And certainly we saw this in the cover-ups that we've done time and time again, the false stories that are out there on various heroes in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the Pat Tillman story. You know, the Army consciously lied and put forth a story that was not true because that was the one the politicians wanted to see out there. Remember the girl from West Virginia? Jessica?
She even came out with it. It was all played.
Yeah. And she was made to be a real heroine of this battle, you know, this fight against the evil, you know, Al-Qaeda or whatever. And, of course, it was nothing like that at all.
Sure.
Nothing at all like that. But the problem is the selling part comes early on, and it sells really well. Who cares what the truth is? And this is what I repeatedly, long before I even worked for the Office of Secretary of Defense, long before 9/11, I had seen it repeatedly done. It's about sales. It's about sales pitches and what sounds good and what will work for politicians to support their goals. And, of course, you know, we live in a country here in America. Our economy, I mean, Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, but I don't even think he could have predicted how terribly important it would become as a productive arm of our economy, as a political influencer. You know, we build a carrier or a big airplane like the B-1. Well, it's got parts and production that's done in all 50 states and some of the territories. We spread out the work. Why we spread out the work? Because this is jobs that are in congressmen's, areas, and it's their constituents. And so if you want to stop a system or cancel it or reduce it, you know, the congressman says, oh, I don't want to reduce jobs. So it's all networked together for a common cause of creating lots and lots of weapons. And politicians find the use of military force extremely attractive, especially if they can sell it easily to a population that is a little bit frightened and a little bit non-educated on foreign policy.
The backers find it attractive, the Pentagon contracts. The backers find it attractive, too.
Oh, absolutely. This is their livelihood, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, and I've written about it, and other people have as well, but, you know, when you drive in your car and you listen to the radio and you hear a commercial for Boeing aircraft or Northrop Grumman, you know, they're not putting an advertisement on the radio or in the newspaper, a full-page spread in the New York Times. They're not doing that because you or me or anyone else in the highway is planning soon to make a big purchase of a Boeing military aircraft. We're not going to do that. They're advertising because those advertisements put lots of money into the pockets of mainstream media, who are therefore basically co-opted in some ways on how they report and how they present stuff. So it's all kind of, you know, kind of works together really, really nicely, unless you have a 19-year-old kid that, you know, can't get a job and goes into the military and gets sent to an occupation somewhere and comes back dead or in pieces. So, we're the only ones that really pay
the price. Let's talk about that. Now, we have a few more minutes and we have to go to a break, but you mentioned your role in, you know, the how they sent you over to, you know, partake in a propaganda campaign. Let's talk a little bit about that, what you actually did. And then the second half, I want to get into the, you know, your Pentagon experience.
Sure.
Boy, we could talk all night.
Sure.
There's so much to discuss here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that, though.
My final tour in the Pentagon was up at the Office of Secretary of Defense and the Undersecretary of Policy for the area of Near East South Asia. And in the summer of 2002, long before the president had really started to talk about going into Iraq. I mean, he started that campaign kind of in the summer. But before the president was really talking about going into Iraq, what I found, and all the folks that I worked with knew, was that the war plan for the actual physical invasion of Iraq was already on its second revision by May of 2002. So here we have military planning going on. It hasn't really been sold to the American people, but it's already a done deal. It's already going to happen. And so what was left to do was sell it to the American people. Well, that requires fear. That requires identification of Saddam Hussein as a very specific and dangerous enemy. It required association of Saddam Hussein with 9/11. Even though some of the same people who would make these statements, such as Colin Powell and Dick Cheney and some of these others, prior to 2002, were saying things like, he's no threat. I think there was a very famous speech by Colin Powell early on when he was Secretary of State before 9/11, where he said, look, we've got, I mean, Saddam Hussein has a fourth-rate military, no Navy, no Air Force, no capability. We've been bombing him and surveilling him for 12 years now. He's got nothing. He's no threat. And then, you know, after 9/11 and before the invasion in early 2003 of Iraq, we see this campaign of demonization of Iraq. And it's not just that he was a demon, but he was a powerful demon. Well, if anybody listened to even Colin Powell a year before, you would have to ask yourself, well, why did he change his, his tune? Well, the tune was being written out of Cheney's office, and of course out of the Office of Special Plans, which was a sister office to where I worked, and we knew the folks that worked in there, and we were the recipient, in fact, of as action officers, as staff officers who put together papers, we were required to use talking points that were developed in OSP, in the Office of Special Plans. Before OSP was formed, we would go to the intelligence, and we would write our background papers based on current intelligence from CIA and DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency.
Right.
After the OSP was formed in the late summer, early fall of 2002, we were instructed immediately, as soon as they moved into their own offices, that from now on we would no longer consult the intelligence on issues of Iraq, terrorism, and WMD, but we would instead make a phone call or an email, secure email, to this Office of Special Plans, which is right upstairs from us, and we would say, well, we have a paper and we need some input. And they would send us an electronic file, a Word document, 1 to 2 to 3 pages long, containing bullets of all kinds of statements. And we were instructed to copy these, cut and paste exactly as they were. Do not delete any. Do not modify any. Put them directly into your paper. Well, these same talking points classified for us were the same things that were in George Bush's speeches and Dick Cheney's speeches. And if you looked at the intelligence, you could see how they were manipulated from what we really knew to kind of shape it so that you would think something totally different. It's called propaganda.
Sure.
We were in the business of doing it, and certainly taking propaganda done by OSP and putting it in our own papers up to all kinds of people that we briefed. So the information is being shaped from the very top and put out through all kinds of avenues, including the media, which is quite interesting since all this stuff's classified in theory. But in fact, if you gave it to the New York Times, to Judith, what was the girl's name? Now I can't remember, the one who was in jail for friend of Scooter Libby. I can't remember her name.
But
New York Times reporter got in a little bit of trouble because she was taking these talking points because she was a friend of the neocons in Washington.
Right.
And they would give her pretty much whatever they were giving us, and she'd put it into articles, giving it an added legitimacy, which, of course, it was illegitimate from to begin with. And it had a purpose, though, and that's something you want to remember. It had a purpose, and that purpose was to bring this nation into a state of readiness to support a long-planned invasion of Iraq. And none of it had to do with the reasons they said. WMD, we knew they didn't have any. Democracy, we had no intention of giving them any democracy, which has, I think, become clear as we've occupied the country now for, 4 or 5 years.
Very interesting. I hope folks are listening to this. I mean, if you have any doubt that your government lies to you and engages in propaganda, here's someone who was involved in doing that very thing.
It does. Now, you know, the thing is, if you study American history, and probably the history of other countries, if you're from another country and you study your own country's history, you're going to find lots of examples where government lies to you, because it really does. It's kind of habitual. But I think it's pretty egregious, the way that we were lied to, particularly after 9/11, in terms of justifying the war in Iraq, and really to some extent justifying the invasion and the war that continues to this day in Afghanistan,
and which they were planning before 9/11, as it turns out as well.
They sure were. And I think
I tell you what, why don't we pick up there? We got to go to a break, but when we get back, I want to get to the heart of the discussion now. What you saw at the Pentagon and 9/11 and how it's been used for these war waging enterprises and whatnot. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with our guest with more interesting explosive information. Karen Kriakowski. We'll be right back.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on Earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.com.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief of the I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.
Okay, folks, welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. The website is thepeoplespeakradio.net. Again, our guest today is Karen Kriakowski. Boy, I wish we had at least 2 hours with her. There's so much to talk about, and she has so much to share. Very important and fascinating information. For those just tuning in, she's been telling us about how she worked for the Pentagon and how one of the duties they gave her was to beef up propaganda to help buttress the war that was coming up in Iraq, you know, to propagandize the public into thinking that this was some terrible threat that we needed to take out. And the whole thing was just a fraud. You know, to the credit of Wolfowitz, I do have to say, he did admit to Ted Koppel, even before the war broke out, 2 weeks ahead of time, it was on March 5th, I remember watching the show, and he said, Ted, it's no secret that this is about oil. Of course, there's other hidden agendas too, but oil was a big one. He said, there's no question it's about oil. You know, we're not hiding that fact. It's on our website, newamericancentury.org. People can go and check it out themselves. And then 2 months later, he told Vanity Fair that the reason given weapons of mass destruction was given for bureaucratic reasons, and that it's something we agreed the American public would be able to accept as a legitimate excuse. So he was admitting that it was a lie.
Yes, he did. Yeah, and I think that's kind of typical in some ways of Wolfowitz. In some ways, he's kind of an innocent, almost a true believer. He's able to actually speak the truth innocently, even though in doing so he incriminates
right.
a whole crowd of
Well, that's good for us.
Yeah, exactly. It's helpful. Just a little correction there. I wasn't asked to change anything, except, well, on Libya, this is a whole different story. But in terms of Iraq propaganda, where I worked in the Pentagon, we were directed to use what was produced by the Office of Special Plans without modification. without correction and without deleting some of the more insane things that they were saying.
Oh, okay.
So we were, like, used as a channel. All the staff officers were in the papers that they wrote, and these same talking points that we were instructed and mandated to use, which, of course, makes us part of the lie, right? I mean, it makes us part of the whole propaganda effort. But those same talking points, those propaganda edited, modified, manipulated bits of intelligence mixed with a little bit of things that aren't true in order to sell this deadly threat that Iraq posed, these things were also being funneled not just to people in the Pentagon and in the government. They were being funneled to places like the New York Times and the Washington Post and other friendly newspapers, government-friendly newspapers that were willing to go ahead without checking. You know, I don't know if Knight Ridder was a newspaper company at the time. They've since been bought out by McClatchy Company. But Knight Ridder was one of the few papers that actually did their own fact-checking on some of these things, because they were given the same stuff, too, but they actually checked it out. And their reporting, of course, not that most Americans were consuming it, but their reporting here in this country was just magnificent and stands the test of time. And if you go back and read what Knight Ridder was saying at the same time that the New York Times and the Post and these others were parroting what the government was giving them, what the Pentagon was giving them, you know, the information was there. There is no excuse, you know, this idea that, oh, we were in, you know, they do such a great job of propaganda. Actually, we did a poor job, both as consumers and citizens, of really, checking out.
Not scrutinizing it, and Yeah.
It's like, Eisenhower said it. He said the citizens have to be vigilant, I guess, against these kinds of trends in government. And we weren't vigilant. Most Americans don't pay the slightest bit of attention to things.
And that's how they get away with it, of course. Keep us distracted, and
That's right, and we are easily distracted, and any people are. It's not just Americans. You can whip up fear. It's the easiest thing in the world to do, and that's kind of the main technique that they did. And you know, they use lies, but we could have figured it out. Many people before the war did. Knight Ridder newspapers is one example of mainstream media that did, and certainly the non-mainstream media was all over it.
To put this into perspective, and then I want to jump into the Pentagon discussion,
sure.
But just for our listeners to really send a message home, you know, for decades we've been claiming that we're the hero, the cop of the world, that we go around taking out evil dictators that are a threat, and we're protecting the world from expanding Soviet communism. But with hindsight, looking back, who can deny it now? The Soviet Union wasn't expanding. They had all they could do to manage their own affairs at home. It was us that was expanding. It was us that was the threat. We invaded over 60 countries around the world, overthrew, in many cases, legitimately elected leaders, and installed total dictators, but they were friendly to Washington, or should I say Wall Street's policies. So, you know, they loved them, and they claimed that they were democratic, but they weren't. They were tyrants. Who's the real threat here?
And, you know, Jean Kirkpatrick, who had been U.N. ambassador under Reagan, she has passed away not too long ago, but she was she's a big neoconservative, believer in the things that these neocons were doing in late 1990s and early 2000s. Very much a believer. Well, she wrote a book kind of justifying how we, as a democratic nation, could overthrow democratically elected leaders and put in place tyrants and put in place dictators of our own choice. She wrote a book about this, kind of explaining the rationale for that kind of hypocrisy. So even the neocons recognized at the time that we weren't behaving like we said we were, but they liked it. They said, oh, that's good, and here's why we can do that. Here's why we can put in place...
They claim the end justifies the mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, the
but the end they're talking about is their fattened wallets.
Well, it's not just their fattened wallets. It is the realization of America as this super...
Hegemony.
American hegemony. And they refer to it as a kind of benevolent hegemony. They think that we're going to be really, really good, even though we may have to knock over your government and we may have to do this and that. We have to bomb you and we have to...
We'll bomb you in a friendly fashion.
And then when it's all done, you'll thank us. You'll be very grateful because we will bring you something better than you have. Well, it might be okay if we actually could deliver on we will bring you something better, but in fact we have not done that. And the neocons themselves don't seem that interested in improving the real lives of a lot of these folks. I mean, if you you know, most of Afghanistan is in incredible poverty, worse poverty and more insecurity than they had even when they were at war with the Soviets.
Well, Karen, what we need to do is get these people on Prozac, like here, and then we can convince them while selling them a rotten bag of goods that we're giving them apple pie.
Well, I'll tell you what, pharmaceuticals may be the answer for how Americans can put up with this for the next
10 years
before it finally explodes in our faces. Medication. Stay on our meds and we'll be okay.
What a mess. But anyway, in the last 20 minutes or so we have, I really wanted to dive into the Pentagon thing. So you were there on the day of 9/11.
Yep.
And, tell us what you saw and heard.
So I worked I was on the fourth floor in the B wing, and, you know, kind of the series of rings, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the A, B, C, D, and E. And the E ring is the outer ring with the windows that might look over the Potomac or over towards Roslyn or whatever, the outside windows. And these are where the top guys work. And there's spokes in the wheel. There's 10 corridors, and I was in 7. Well, this put me about a third of the way around the building and 3 floors up above from where the point of impact was. I was in the B ring at the time, with our window in the B ring where we were, the office that we were sitting in at the time of the impact on 9/11, was looking towards the center of the building, looking towards the... So basically, when whatever it was came in, hit and blew up, what we ended up seeing was a huge fireball on the roof of the building, because it's only 5 stories above the ground, and we were on the 4th story. So we had a pretty good view of the roof of the building, and looking out our window pretty much a third of the way around, we see this huge fireball, and that's our introduction. Now, we are in this office with our television set turned to CNN. Why are we in there? Well, we had a 10 o'clock staff meeting. We started going early, turned the TV on, and we're watching video of the burning... the first tower that was hit was burning. People were saying, an airplane had hit it. And then, as we're watching TV, of course, we saw what all the folks watching TV saw, right, which was a second airplane impact and fire and whatnot. So we're watching the first one. They said it was an airplane had taken off from somewhere, and, you know, so we're thinking, all of us in the Pentagon, all the people, I don't know about the whole Pentagon, obviously they're thinking, other people in the Pentagon thinking all kinds of things, but in our office, we are looking at each other, we're talking, we're saying, a faulty navigational system. We thought of it as an error, as a mistake. This is an accident. But when we watched the second plane hit, then everybody looks at each other, and some of the guys basically felt, hey, this is calculated. This is something done on purpose, by design, and America is under attack. They're already believing and thinking that we're under attack. And we do have a kind of a weird feeling. And then shortly thereafter, we hear this boom, and some people felt the shake where we were in my office. I did not feel the building shake where I was, but some people said, oh, they felt the shake. But loud noise, looked out the window, and we see this fireball on the roof. And what it looks like to us, have no idea what it is. What it looks like is in the movies, when a bomb is dropped on something and it just explodes right where it impacts. It looked like the bomb had been dropped from above and hit the roof. That's what it looked like. It was this big, fat, red-orange fireball.
Wow.
Looking at this thing, we're going, okay, now people are looking at each other. Now, we are working in a secure facility. We have a couple of different safes, a SCIF facility there, an FBI place. So we've got multiple safe doors to lock and other things to lock. And, you know, there's procedures when you close down your office. And so we basically, at that point, begin to... there's no smoke where we are, there's no fire, there's no screaming. There's also no announcements on the intercom system at that point. It's very silent. The alarms don't even go off.
No kidding. That's very interesting, because that happened at the WTC.
This was one of the things they fixed after 9/11, because the building had such terrible, total information system, broadcast-type system. So we go through the procedure. Some people who don't have responsibilities to do that, to set safes or whatever, they just grab their stuff and go. And then a few of us take our time. And I actually was not overly concerned, partly because I didn't see smoke. You know how it is. When you see smoke, you're like panicking. If you don't see smoke, it's going to take a while for it to get over here, et cetera. So we set up our stuff and lock our safes and lock the doors. And a few of us we're like the last people out. And we walk through the facility towards the exit, and we're walking towards the E-ring, and we're walking towards the opposite direction of where the impact was.
Yeah.
And this is the same exit that all of the bigwigs would use, because I worked with OSD at that time, the Office of Trade Defense, so we're on the side of the building, corridors 8, 9, 10. Those corridors are where, on the outermost ring, the E-ring, is where the bigwigs sit, the Office of Trade Defense and Wolf Lips and these guys. So the building is almost vacant, and as we're walking out, we do hear announcements. There's nobody hardly in the building at that point, a few minutes, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, maybe about 10 minutes after the impact. The building is mostly vacated. We do hear a very scratchy, unintelligible announcement that's being repeated, and it's we don't know what it's, you can't. I was with somebody, and we're just saying, do you understand what that guy's saying? And nobody can understand what he's saying. But we figured, obviously, it leaves the building, that kind of thing. So we're leaving the building. We go out onto the side of the building, which is not facing the point of impact, but we are immediately directed to our left, and we walk around left, and to the left is where the helicopter pad is, and that's where that green, you know, field is, or lawn. And so we walk around to that side of the building, and we're sitting there staring, all of us. I mean, thousands of people are standing out there.
In shock.
In total shock, very surreal. And we're watching the building, watching this hole burn, basically. And this is the thing that I have written about before, and I'm sure other people have as well. You know, I didn't witness anything going into the Pentagon. Where I was in the building, when I see fire, you know, we see this fireball on the roof, and we don't even realize that it has come in between the first and second floors, that it has exploded through, you know, the ceiling, and that's what produces. We don't know where it came from. We just see it. So we walk around, we see the point of impact and the hole, and the lawn is unlittered by anything that you would expect for a major aircraft, but we don't even know what it is. We don't know.
Right. Now, no debris. The lawn isn't torn up.
Well, we don't see debris. We're looking for it, though, because why are we looking for it? Because everybody thinks, well, there was an airplane, one airplane in the tower, then a second airplane, which we saw. So we're thinking, you know, could be airplanes, but it could be something else. But we're looking for debris. There's not much. There is some stuff. Pieces of gear could come from cars or other things, but there's no luggage. There's no lightweight material. There's no anything that would indicate... well, what we were later told that it was.
And which is what Jamie McIntyre said from CNN.
That was what I saw from a little bit out where the road is, on the side, looking over the helicopter pad, looking directly at the burning gas in the building. Now, shortly after I got there, and I mean within minutes of having gone out there with the people, all the people who were either wearing a uniform, military uniform, that would include me, and people who were civilians who were reservists, in their weekend reservists or whatnot, so they would be wearing civilian clothes if they had their military role. We were called, all of us. There was an announcement made. Guy walked through, said, all you guys come down to the basic flat part of the field in front of this hole that was still burning, and line up in groups of four, because the idea was that if anyone was, we would basically serve as, what do they call it, you know, stretcher duty, and there were some ambulances out there. In case there were any folks that escaped out of that side or were rescued out of that side. Now, we were formulated in these little rows of four people on the lawn in front of the Pentagon, so now we're even closer to the point of impact. And everybody's looking around. You know, we're looking around. Now, we're talking to each other, and there were a number of folks there who had were smoke skinned, otherwise disheveled from having escaped a little bit, you know. I mean, I walked out of the building like in a practice drill. There was no smoke, anything. But there were a number of folks, of course, that had come through smoke and fire. And so some of these folks are out there, and they're a little shook up. But we're all standing on the lawn, and we're looking around. We're not blind. And there's nothing there. There's no debris to speak of. So, you know, but we don't really put two and two together at that point. This is just what we're seeing in a state of shock. At some point, it didn't take too long, maybe another 10 or 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so, it became clear that no one was coming out of that side, dead or alive, no one was being rescued out of that side, and that all of the rescue operations for actual people that had been burned, and I think we lost something like 128.
Yeah.
picture of
Well, that area of the building was sparsely populated. I mean, they had recently renovated it, right?
Sparsely populated, that's true. And a number of folks were escaped, and then, of course, some were incinerated, and that was not something that was really... There were a number of folks that were being treated for burns, but they were being taken through the center of the Pentagon and then out the other side, the opposite side from where we were.
Mm-hmm.
They had plenty of folks helping them, so we were not directed to go to that other side at some point, not too long. They realized nobody's coming out this side, and we were released to go. And at that point, many people had already started walking.
Now, this was before there was a collapse of the facade, and, you know, of course, the hole widened at that point, right? This is shortly after the strike.
Yeah.
Did you notice the hole being unusually small?
Well, the question is, unusually small for what? We didn't know what it was. Anymore.
Well, right, yeah, sure.
Yeah, if you think back later when they said a big airliner had hit it, yeah, you look at what you saw, it makes no sense.
Right.
And the thing is,
It was basically a window, wasn't it, that it went through?
There were windows there, but there's the whole lineup has windows. I think the hole was, I don't know what the actual measurements were, but you could see it. I mean, it was big enough to see, but it's certainly not big enough for an airplane to melt in.
Yeah, they said about 16 feet wide.
Yeah. So the thing is, if you weren't told, and we weren't told necessarily that it was an airplane, there was no other evidence that you could draw that it was an airplane, except if you had watched television and say, well, there was an airplane in one tower, there was an airplane in another tower. There may be more airplanes. So the idea was out there amongst all of us, from what little that we did know, that somehow airplanes were being used as weapons. So you say, well, an airplane was used as a weapon, here we have this hole. Well, you're not putting two and two together until after you think about it, and you realize what you didn't see. And what we didn't see was any evidence at all. And no one there has come up with, I mean, you know, people are taking pictures, people have cell phones. There's lots of people tracking what is going on, recording it after the fact in various ways, and nothing, no pictures have emerged of anything different than what I saw at the time, like within minutes of this attack and for the whole hour or so, you know, afterwards. It was a debris-free green lawn.
20,000 pounds of airplane, where'd it go?
That's right, and also there was no serious disruption that we could see from where we were on that lawn. You know, it wasn't like green with a huge gash of red, you know, soil or busted up concrete driving parking lot or anything like that. It was just like it looked normal, except for here you have this round thing burning, of course. And of course, we are transfixed by this burning of the Pentagon. It's a very shocking thing to see because, first off, it's not, you know, it may look like a fortress, but we think of it as being an office building, and it certainly is an office building. Yes, it's a symbol of a military power, but, you know, we don't think of it as a target. We didn't think of it as a target. And so to see it there burning, it is really shocking. But, yeah, no evidence of debris in any type of thing. And I've never seen any pictures by folks that were there or any other recorders of that event that have shown debris anywhere.
And, right.
You know, so it doesn't. It's inconsistent with what we know about normal passenger airplanes of that size, 767 or whatever it was.
Let me ask you, are you familiar with the smell of cordite, you know, the explosive?
You know, I'm personally not. No, I'm not.
Because there was one general who came out and said he smelled cordite immediately. He, you know, he thought it was a bomb that went off.
Really?
Yeah. Did you hear any...
I know after we came back to work a few days later, we were in the Pentagon, and of course a lot of it is... you know, Mark is cordoned off for safety reasons and because it had burned. But most of the way the circular hallways are going around, the smoke contaminated a good much of the building. And the smell of that smoke was unlike normal, you know, fuel fire type stuff. But I don't know what cordite smells like or anything else. I couldn't tell you.
But it was unusual, huh?
Chemical smell. To me it was, but I haven't been, I don't have a lot of experience in buildings that are burned.
How about this? Did you hear any secondary explosions after the initial impact? Did you notice any other, like, you know, boom sounds?
No,
or
we really didn't. We didn't. But again, we're a third of the way around the building, and we're not standing at the window staring either. We're
yeah.
busy, you know, locking up our facility our safes and things like that. But, no, I didn't hear any secondary things. But the interesting thing about it, at least what I've read, is how far into the Pentagon the thing, whatever it was that hit it, penetrated.
Right.
It went through, you know, wall after wall of
steel-reinforced concrete.
Concrete and limestone, yeah. And it went through, you know, basically not like you would think a non-reinforced aluminum hulled airliner would do. It went through like a missile would do, and that's unfortunate because we have no idea what it was. But it went through multiple levels in a straight line, penetrating those things. And if you look at where the explosion was, I mean, we're standing on we're at the B-ring internal window looking out on the roof, the five-story above-the-ground building. And we see this fireball. Well, this fireball was not on the edge of the building. It looked to me somewhere between 3 and 4 rings in. So the fireball is pretty far in the building, much farther than you would think if something like a airliner splatted on the outside.
Right, right. This whole thing just stinks, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes you think, and makes you wonder. Now, here's the thing. The evidence that I saw and what I've seen since then and what I've looked at does not support to me, with my limited knowledge, doesn't support that an airplane went in there. But, you know, of course, the government says an airplane went in there, and it said that what happened, I guess the government's explanation for why there's no debris, because, see, there's really no argument that there's not a lot of debris out there. There was no debris. So the government's answer is that, you know, that this aluminum-hulled jet with glass and whatnot penetrated this concrete, 1, 2, 3, 4 layers, however much you had to go through, and then the wings folded in behind it.
So, yeah, doesn't make sense.
That's what they say. You can read 9/11 reports. They kind of explain it that way. That's very strange. That's you know,
definitely.
You're not going to see this airplane wreck on any Discovery Channel exposés of airplane wrecks, because this one doesn't match any of the other airplane wrecks we've ever had, whether it's been on land or sea.
It looks like the PNAC group got their new Pearl Harbor type event, doesn't it?
Well, they were certainly waiting for something like that to be leveraged. And,
very strange.
You know, yeah, and the other thing that's strange, the biggest thing to me, maybe not strange as a study in American history, but, you know, the really, really poor job that the government itself did, all the agencies, NIST or any of them, the really strange and incompetent job that these agencies did in explaining what it was they think went on. You know, certainly
right.
Most didn't even want to have any type of research. We posed this for a long time before the 9/11 Commission was even put together. Then it comes up with a report that is really unsatisfying from a scientific standpoint.
Oh, they even admitted that, you know, there needs to be another investigation, that they were lied to by several federal agencies.
Well,
and you know what? Real quick, Karen, because we got to cut it short, unfortunately. One last point. Did you want to get in?
Mm-hmm. No. It was a criminal event, and we didn't treat it as a crime scene.
Right. There's too many unanswered questions. I'll tell you what, is there any any website or anything you want to plug?
Oh, I don't know. There's for 9/11. Oh, for 9/11 or?
Oh, yourself or, you know, your testimony?
Myself, I pretty much write for LouRockwell.com, and I highly recommend everyone visit LouRockwell.com. It's
yeah, that's a great site.
Okay, WELL.com. 6 days a week, it's got a series of both op-ed pieces and news articles, and just a really great source. The Mises Institute is, Lou Rockwell is the president of that, and the Mises Institute looks at economic issues and concerns, and just what tons of good information. You can self-educate. I highly recommend Lou Rockwell, and that's where my articles are periodically. I think I had one up today on the candidate. And then as far as 9/11, it's a shame that we cannot talk freely about what may or may not have happened on 9/11, but certainly there's more and more information uncovered all the time. And
right.
People should educate themselves, not go crazy. We don't know what happened.
And don't be intimidated.
There's a lot of things we can agree that we don't know, and I think that's
right. Okay, Karen, I want to thank you for coming on again. Sorry to cut you short, but we're really running low on time. But once again, Karen Kwiatkowski, thanks again. Great stuff. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Take care.
All right. Okay.
Okay, folks, that's all the time we have for tonight. Tomorrow's guest is going to be Joseph Lentini. He's a USS Liberty survivor. Going to be talking about that fiasco that went on back in 1967. You don't want to miss that. We'll see you then. Take care.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the seawall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.